When Einstein was asked if he believed in God, he said he believed in Spinoza's God. Bertrand Russell called Spinoza the noblest and most lovable of the great philosophers. More recently, the neurologist Antonio Damasio made Spinoza a central figure in his theory about emotion and consciousness. So what's all the fuss about this 17th century philosopher? Well, Baruch Spinoza was a man far ahead of his time. Though he grew up among Orthodox Jews, he believed in the power of reason above all else, which got him branded a heretic. Spinoza is now the subject of a book by the novelist and philosopher Rebecca Goldstein. It's called Betraying Spinoza.
Spinoza himself never called himself an atheist. He was soundly denounced throughout 17th century Europe. He was first excommunicated from his community of birth, the Jewish community of Amsterdam. He was excommunicated at the age of 23, and nobody in that community was allowed to read him. So he was denounced as an atheist, one, because, you know, he didn't believe in a transcendent God. God is immanent within nature. He meant by nature something quite different from, you know, trees and rivers. And also he thought that we could deduce purely through the faculty of reason how we ought to live, how we ought to treat one another. And so we don't need to have any recourse to a supernatural authority. There's no authority but us in this world, but that's sufficient.
The essential sin, if sin it is, that he seems to have committed is to deny the necessity of faith.
Yes, he denies the necessity of faith. In fact, in his system, not only is it unnecessary, it's unethical. To believe in the absence of reasons, to make that leap of faith, to say, you know, I believe despite all in the face of evidence, to him, this is a violation of our human responsibility to ground all of our beliefs as best we can. So for him, faith is not only not necessary, it's downright immoral.
In the book that you've written, this is especially startling for you, I gather, because you were raised in strict teaching to believe in the necessity of faith. How did you first come across Spinoza?
Yes, well, I had the great fortune, I suppose, to grow up in a community that bore some striking similarities to Spinoza's own community. I grew up also in a quite insular religious community, Orthodox Judaism, and also a community, many of the members of which had been traumatized by a Jewish catastrophe. In Spinoza's case, it was the Portuguese-Spanish Inquisition. His community was mostly composed of refugees from that still ongoing horrific experiment in intolerance. And I grew up in a community, the remnants of a once flourishing family in Hungary, who had also been decimated by that horrific experiment in intolerance in Nazi Germany. And I went to a school that was very, very Orthodox, and I first heard of Spinoza in a course in Jewish history in which he was set out as an example of what can go so terribly wrong if one uses one's reason to question the basic tenets of religion. So he was really set out as a kind of cautionary tale against the arrogance of reason, and I was hooked.
For an outsider looking at this, of course, it sounds as though any teenager would have been fascinated by a man of such great intellect who was also a great rebel. Now, that can't have been true for everyone because the teacher was clearly using this in the expectation that it would drive you away from Spinoza forever.
Yeah, no, it's true. And mind you, this was a time of great rebelliousness. It was the late 60s, and here we were in, you know, an all-girls school with our skirts down to our ankles, and the teachers had their hands full. But the great adventure of pure reason that led him outside of his community and that caused him to have a very difficult life, I guess to many, many of the students in that school, didn't sound terribly appealing, but it did to me.
Led him outside of his community, you said. In fact, he was excommunicated and barred from even speaking to anyone in his community. Is that right?
That's right. The writ of excommunication is very, very strong. He's cursed with every curse in Deuteronomy, and everybody in the community is exhorted to have nothing to do with him. He was at that time in business with his younger brother, and, you know, his younger brother couldn't speak to him. Nobody in his family was allowed to speak to him. And he seemed to have accepted it all almost with a degree of satisfaction.
Well, of course, you can consider it a blessing in a way, because had it not been so extreme, had he not been, as he put it, freed to think and say and write what he wanted to, we would not know the philosophy of Spinoza that we know today.
It's interesting to think, you know, could he have done the same sort of thinking so outside the bounds of anything that had come before? He is influenced, I should say, by the great French Catholic philosopher René Descartes. So it was, I shouldn't say it's unprecedented, and he did learn on his own. He's also influenced somewhat by Hobbes. So he did, once he left the community, he did become familiar with other scholars. He learned Latin. He wrote in Latin. But yes, I think if the hostility and the renunciation of his community hadn't been quite so bitter and final, maybe he could have made his peace with it, and the magnificent system never have seen the light of day. Hmm.
He seems to have had a very complicated relationship with not just his family, but with his religion. There is a suggestion that, he was definitely ostracized by Jews, but he clearly drew on Jewish thinkers. He respected the ideas, at least as beginning points, for the construction of his theories of philosophy.
Yes, it's true. I mean, I would tell my students that if you take Cartesianism, you know, the thinking of Descartes, and Kabbalah, which is the mystical tradition in Judaism, and you put them together, you get Spinoza. But this is clearly a simplification, but definitely there are seeds of Jewish thinking within Spinoza. And there's also, I think, emotionally, that the trauma that so surrounded him in that community had an impact on him. So the great issue of his life is religious intolerance and what should be the divide between religion and the pursuit of truth. He didn't think that religion really had anything to do with the pursuit of truth. It has its place. It's a way in which we can bond with our fellow, with people, form a community. It's a way in which we can mark the important passages of lifetime, you know, birth and death and coming of age, and all of these rituals are very important for this feeling of intimacy with one's community. But we should see it as celebrating the significance of our lives and not as the pursuit of truth. For the pursuit of truth, we have the faculty of reason, and that is an arduous, difficult endeavor to come to truth. And religion is just not about that, he says. And that was, for him, this would be a wonderful, if we would see this, this would free us from the power that religion has to make, you know, lives miserable. If one particular religion assumes that it knows exactly what it is that God is and what God wants from us, and woe be to anybody who doesn't believe the same, you know, the horrors that can follow. And he felt this, I think, in the marrow of his bones. How could he have not, having grown up in the community that had been so victimized by the Spanish-Portuguese Inquisition, and then victimized him?
Rebecca Goldstein. Her book is called Betraying Spinoza, The Renegade Jew Who Gave Us Modernity.